This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Neither party wants to offend the fossil fuel industry. They want to win the election, and they know the power of the fossil fuel industry. You can't turn on your television without seeing these advertisements about clean coal, clean tar sands, and the claim that there's more jobs associated with fossil fuels than with other energies. That's, of course, not true, but they're hammering that into the voters' heads. And so if anyone challenges the fossil fuel industry, first of all, they're going to lose the money that they get from the fossil fuel industry. And secondly, they're going to have the fossil fuel industry against them in the election. The politicians are not willing to say that we cannot burn all the fossil fuels without guaranteeing a different planet and cheating our children.
That was NASA scientist James Hansen speaking on The Young Turks on Current TV. I'm Alex Smith. No matter who was elected in the United States, the fossil fuel companies won. This year, big oil, coal, and gas made more money than anyone in the history of money. And a Supreme Court decision called Citizens United let big corporations spend hundreds of millions to fund politicians. But there was another judgment made recently. In the court of nature, reality has spoken. Deny climate change all the way to the bank, but we will all pay billions, even pay with our lives, as Earth's climate is destabilized. The residents of New York and New Jersey got an ugly taste of the different planet James Hansen has warned us about for the past 25 years. Can we protect New York City from the next big surge of rising seas? What about Washington and Baltimore? What happens to all that expensive real estate with oceanfront views? We'll talk with a scientist about storm surge controls around the world. It will cost tens of billions, but as always, the cost of doing nothing is even more. Of course, we can still prevent the worst by switching to renewable energy. Daphne Weisham brings us a key interview from Germany, where renewables are booming. Hermann Ott is a member of the German Federal Parliament, but even he knows renewables cannot power our current overamped civilization. But first, we're going to hear from a man who wrote the book on the New York storm surge, predicting the whole mess we've just seen in a book published 6 years ago. That's Mike Tidwell. Ah, New York. Let's warm up with Billy Joel's Miami 2017, rewritten for New York after Sandy and performed live at the NBC Red Cross fundraiser November 2nd.
Go out on Broadway. I saw the Empire State a little low. Storm went on beyond the Palisades, out in the Rockaways, the oceans overflowed. We held a concert out in Brooklyn.
Who could have foreseen the amount of damage Hurricane Sandy caused in New York City and New Jersey? Well, Mike Tidwell sure did. A half dozen years ago, Tidwell published his book titled The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. Mike is the founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness about global warming in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. He's also a filmmaker and an award-winning environmentalist. Mike Tidwell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
so much for having me.
Now, when you published The Ravaging Tide, what did you say could happen to New York City?
You know, anyone who looks at a map and sees the geographic features of New York Harbor and Manhattan is made quickly aware of the fact that if a big surge tide from a hurricane were to enter that New York Harbor and surrounding areas, there's nowhere for the water to go but up. You know, basically New York Harbor and the East River and Hudson River form a kind of catchment for water. And once that water gets in there, literally there's nowhere for it to spread out. There are no vast wetlands, interior wetlands, or flat areas. And the only place for the water to go is up, which is why New York is in many ways a basket case waiting to happen. And when I wrote my book in 2006 after Katrina, you know, many of us concerned about climate change, you know, lifted our gaze to say, well, if this kind of disaster can happen in New Orleans, where else might it happen from, you know, the combination of sea level rise and rising sea surface temperatures that provide the fuel for hurricanes? If a really big hurricane hit elsewhere in the United States, where might the most damage be caused? And New York just, you know, jumped out at me during my research. And that's why I basically, in my 2006 book, described pretty much everything we've seen the last week. In fact, the paperback version of that book, also that came out in 2006, has an illustration of Manhattan with water pouring into it in a really sort of spooky, foreshadowing way. So I guess it just, you know, anyone who's out of denial about climate change and is looking at the real reality of sea level rise and bigger storms, you know, was very clear that New York was vulnerable. And even Mayor Michael Bloomberg was warning about these impacts potentially happening.
And how was your book received? Did people believe it or criticize or just ignore it?
Well, the book was published by Free Press, and it got good reviews, but, you know, there's that whole people not wanting to hear bad news, and change is difficult for people. And I have a friend who's told me, please stop writing books, because in 2003, I wrote another book called Bayou Farewell that predicted the Katrina hurricane disaster. Literally, the subtitle of that 2003 book was The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast, again, published in 2003, 2 years before the Katrina disaster, because that disaster was obvious to anyone paying attention as well, because of the poor levees, the rising ocean levels, the disappearing wetlands and barrier islands. Katrina was a disaster foretold by many journalists and activists like myself for many years before it came. But even in that book was not well received before it came out, warning about a potential Katrina. And the 2006 book, The Ravaging Tide, again, good reviews. But this country is kind of slow to let in the reality of climate change. And as a result, we're delaying solutions so long that we're entering a period of consequences, serious consequences. And that's, I think, what we've seen with Hurricane Sandy. You know, we all hope that we can respond fast enough and get off of carbon fuels fast enough this century to prevent the worst impacts of global warming. But you have to wonder, what is it going to take? And is it going to take Katrina 2, 3, and 4 and Sandy 5, 6, and 7? I don't know. I hope not.
Well, in a recent press conference, you explained a new concept that everybody needs to grasp after Hurricane Sandy, and I'm talking about that continual line in scientific circles and echoed by the press that says you can never blame a single storm like Sandy on climate change. What do you say to that?
Well, the real answer to that question, did global warming cause Sandy? The real answer is yes, absolutely. And how can someone say with certainty that global warming caused Sandy when we've been told over and over again that you can't tie any single weather event to global warming? The reason you can say with certainty that global warming caused Sandy is because we've changed the great ecological systems of this planet. Nobody can deny that we are already seeing sea level rise. We've had about a foot of sea level rise worldwide in the last 100 years, attributed almost entirely to global warming. When you melt the land-based glaciers, the oceans rise. When you heat the oceans in terms of temperature, the water expands. And those two factors together cause sea level rise. So we know sea level rise is happening. There's no controversy there. You can measure it. It is a fact. We also know that we've increased moisture in the atmosphere because of global warming. The warmer the planet is, the more evaporation occurs over oceans and the more moisture is in the atmosphere. So that's number two. We know there's been a 5% increase in moisture in the global atmosphere just since the 1970s. And then on top of that, we know we've raised the sea surface temperatures of the world's oceans, including the Atlantic Ocean. Those are all not disputable. Those are facts. More moisture, you can measure it, higher ocean temperatures, and more sea level rise. So we've systemically changed the planet already. And systemically, those are the main drivers of Hurricane Sandy: warm water, sea level rise, and more moisture in the atmosphere. So systemically, we clearly made Sandy the monster that she was because we've changed these systems. And when you look at it from that perspective, in terms of systemic causation, then it's clear that the fingerprints of climate change are all over this hurricane, undeniably.
Mike, do you know where that concept of systemic causation came from? And who started that out?
Well, I first learned it actually about a week ago from the great linguist George Lakoff. Yeah. He first, I saw an email that he sent out to everyone making the same argument that I just made of systemic causation. And I think it's undeniable. It's irrefutable. It's the way that we need to start talking about climate change in terms of individual extreme weather events.
Well, look, maybe Fox News and Mitt Romney don't believe in climate change, or at least last week Mitt didn't, but insurance companies sure do. Tell us about that.
The insurance companies are not Republican corporations. They're not Democratic corporations. They're corporations, and they have their private capital at risk. And that's where, if you really want to know what's really happening and what the real truth on climate change is, just watch the private insurance companies. They are warning that extreme weather is increasing and that climate change is happening. Why are they warning? Because they're affected by it. They're harmed by it. Travelers Insurance just a month ago sent me, I have Travelers Insurance Company for my own homeowner's policy here in Montgomery County, Maryland. And Travelers sent me a notice just a month ago with a color flyer illustration of a two-story home with a garage, sort of all-American Main Street home. And that home is in the same illustration from my friendly insurance company, the Red Umbrella People. There is a tornado in the illustration about to hit the home. There are dark storm clouds over the home. And this illustration had the facts on it from Travelers. It said extreme weather events are increasing in the United States, and as a result, the cost of insurance is going up. Now, this was not mailed to me by Al Gore. Again, it wasn't mailed to me by Greenpeace. It was mailed to me by Travelers Insurance Company. And at the very bottom, it said, what is the source of our information? And they note scientific information. They note information from the international reinsurance company, Munich Re, highly respected, all saying that extreme weather events are going up because of global climate change linked to the combustion of fossil fuels. So that's Travelers Insurance. Also in my state of Maryland, Allstate Insurance announced in 2006 that it would no longer issue new homeowners policies in the 11 easternmost counties of Maryland. Why? Because according to Allstate, Atlantic storms are getting bigger and sea level is rising, and as a result, they are retreating from many coastal markets in the mid-Atlantic. Again, these are real companies making real bottom-line decisions, and you know it should be a matter of concern to us because climate change ultimately will make the insurance virtually impossible. Insurers have to have predictable outcomes. They have to be able to measure the future based on what they've seen in the past in order to set premium rates and gauge their risk. If they can no longer gauge their risk, we can't have insurance, and without insurance, you can't have a modern Western economy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Mike Tidwell, director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and author of the book The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. Well, Mike, talking about the coming death of America's coastal cities is pretty provocative. Is there really a possibility we'll have to abandon some coastal cities?
Well, you know, my publisher, Free Press, came up with that depressing title, The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and the Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. You know, most people want to reach for the razor blades when they hear that title. But the intent of the publisher was to really try to shock readers into understanding that these are the kind of things that will happen unless we take action. If we do take action to switch to clean, renewable energy as fast as we can, our leading climate scientists worldwide say that we can probably avoid the worst impacts of global climate change. And by worst impacts, I mean, you know, not just 1 or 2 or 3 feet of sea level rise, but up to 30 feet of sea level rise if the Greenland ice sheet disappears. We can't adapt to that. We would have to abandon coastal cities if we got 30 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century. The worst impacts also include just the kind of catastrophic droughts on a regular scale that we've seen in North America this past year, the kind of growing size of storms and all these impacts together. That's what a world of 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees more warming. We can't go there. We do have to do some adaptation. I mean, we have some more warming in the bank no matter what we do, because carbon dioxide lingers in the atmosphere for up to a century after you release it from the combustion of fossil fuels. So there's a momentum toward more warming and more ocean rise no matter what we do, but it's still more in the adaptable range. And so what we need to do is start to adapt to the warming we can't prevent, and we need to prevent the warming that we can't adapt to. You know, 1 or 2 more degrees of warming, we're going to have to build floodgates for New York City. We're going to have to build levees for many of our coastal cities. But there's a reasonable chance that we can still inhabit these coastal areas. However, if we get to 3 or 4 or 5 degrees of warming and the Greenland ice sheet disappears, then we will see the death of most of our coastal cities just because they won't be habitable. You're not going to be able to live in areas that are perpetually in flood state, perpetually pelted by rain and threatened by high winds. And so it is a very real threat. I think that Hurricane Sandy is a curtain raiser. I think that Mayor Michael Bloomberg had it right this past week when he said, we have old infrastructure in New York, and we have a new reality in terms of weather. And what he meant by that was, one, we have to confront climate change. We have to acknowledge that it's real. It's one of the reasons Michael Bloomberg gave for endorsing President Obama for the presidency. And we also, the mayor is realistic to acknowledge, need to adapt to much of it as well. And that's a scary new world that we're entering. You know, the idea of major floodgates for New York City and levees in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, sort of the New Orleansization of many of our coastal cities, you know, sort of committing to the New Orleans model of living below sea level behind levees, is a scary prospect, but one that we're going to have to embrace at some level to adapt to the global warming that's already happening.
Boy, we're in a tough spot because the governments are already going broke and the energy companies have never made more money. Exxon and Chevron made more money than in the history of money. And they're pouring it all into political donations with Citizens United and so on. So I'm wondering, do you think Sandy could break the current deadlock in America where politicians won't even talk about global warming or not?
You know, I think, Alex, that we're reaching a point where the pain of storms like Sandy, the damage caused by the June 2012 derecho storm that caused so much damage and across much of the United States, the frequency of these new superstorms will very soon, it's my prediction, lead companies like Allstate Insurance Company and Travelers Insurance Company to begin pointing to ExxonMobil and Peabody Coal and these major insurance companies saying to ExxonMobil, your company is putting my company out of business. And I think that when you have major, you know, mainstream corporations like the insurers pointing to the oil companies and saying, you're putting us out of business with your dirty energy, then the political center of gravity really shifts in this country. And I think that that's where we're headed. Now, many of the insurers, ironically and tragically, are hesitant to say that the fossil fuel companies are causing global warming. They're quick now to acknowledge that global warming is happening, the insurers are. They're quick to acknowledge that there's more extreme weather because that's how they have to justify increasing their premiums. But they're slow to talk about oil and coal as a source. Why? Why would insurers be hesitant to talk about the source of the harm to their industry? It's because insurers don't make most of their money from the premiums they charge us. That's not how they make their money. They make their money by investing our premiums into the stock market. They invest those premiums, and that's how they make most of their money. And most of the insurance companies now are investing heavily, like many average Americans and Canadians, in ExxonMobil and other fossil fuel companies. So they're hesitant to say that oil and coal is causing climate change because they're afraid that these corporations somehow will be damaged and it will reduce the investment values that the insurance companies get. So it's a tragic sort of linkage that ultimately is dooming the very existence of these same insurance companies. They're going to have to break that sort of conspiracy of silence so soon because it's really an existential issue for the major insurers.
Well, and hopefully the people of America, the people who are getting washed out and having such severe damage and always having to clean up and rebuild and losing their homes and even losing their loved ones, they're going to put some pressure on the politicians and say, look, this is really happening. Do something.
I think you're seeing more of that. I think that, you know, having the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, mention climate change repeatedly in the aftermath of Sandy, the mayor of New York City, a political independent, mentioning climate change, you know, as a core problem. You had the Bloomberg Business Week magazine on its cover this week. It said in very large letters, it's global warming stupid, playing on the Bill Clinton phrase in early 90s of it's the economy stupid. And the executive editor of Bloomberg Business Week tweeted out this week that magazine cover about global warming is only controversial to stupid people. To people who are informed and paying attention, there's no controversy. We see it outside our front door. We see it every day. We see it monthly as the power continues to go out. And I think that polling in the United States shows that more and more Americans are noticing extreme weather, are linking it to climate change, and more want something to be done about it. But the big challenge, again, is going up against the money, the oceans of money, as you mentioned, of ExxonMobil and the natural gas companies pouring it into our political system, you know, buying off, you know, buying the silence of many politicians. But there just comes a point where it just can't be ignored politically any further.
Mike Tidwell, how can people find out more about you, your books, and the Chesapeake Climate Action Network?
Well, listeners can go to ChesapeakeClimate.org. That's ChesapeakeClimate.org. And you can find all the information about what my group is doing in the Mid-Atlantic to champion clean energy solutions and raise awareness about climate change, not just on the East Coast of the United States, but across America and across the world. And also, you can see my writings. You can find all my writings there, including my book, The Ravaging Tide, which is there to read for free online. And that's where you go, ChesapeakeClimate.org.
We've been talking with author, filmmaker, and environmental leader Mike Tidwell. And thank you so much for joining us on such short notice, Mike.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Could New York have been saved from the storm surge of Hurricane Sandy? Can we protect other cities like Washington, D.C. or Baltimore? What about the rest of near-coastal residents? Joining us now is Professor J. Court Stevenson from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Cambridge, Maryland. Professor Stevenson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
The devastation in New York State and New Jersey from Hurricane Sandy was shocking, but would you say it was predictable?
Well, in the long term, it is, but in the short term, I think it came as a shock to me. I actually grew up around New York Harbor. My dad had a boatyard on Staten Island, which actually you're probably seeing in the news right now. We encountered several hurricanes during the course of my younger days when I was there, and each one was terrifying in its own way, but I never really would have expected that the subway system would have been disabled in such a drastic way, and I was really surprised by the Hoboken flooding, too. So in the abstract, yes, I was really thinking that this could happen, but when it actually is here, it's shocking.
Well, I think I'm in the same boat there, and so are a lot of people. You know, on Radio EcoShock, we interview a lot of scientists and activists saying we have to cut emissions, and so far it hasn't worked. Now we have to look at adapting to extreme climate events while we cut greenhouse gas emissions. What could New York do to prevent more catastrophes like Sandy, do you think?
Well, I know that Mayor Bloomberg had convened, I think he called it a subcommittee, several years ago, even it's they started. So it's been a question for a while whether New York Harbor could be protected from surges like the one we got from Sandy. The problem with New York Harbor is right now there's three entrances. One is at Hell Gate, which is actually comes off of Long Island Sound. The main one is in the Narrows. Narrows goes between Brooklyn and Staten Island. And that's the main passage that the big ships come into the harbor. The other one is a smaller passage, but nonetheless important because of the tanker traffic. It's the Kildan Cull. So you'd have to really stop up those three passages, so that gets pretty complicated rather quickly. I'm sure that the committee is looking at other options, too. There's one that is even more encompassing, which would actually be one long barrier from Sandy Hook going north to the Rockaways, and you'd have to have a major opening there that would be convertible up and down, or depending on how you wanted to do it. But at they call it the Ambrose Channel. It's the big channel that goes in and out of New York Harbor. So it is doable to really prevent a surge, I think. And definitely the mayor, I think, is probably looking at those options more carefully right now. The problem is it takes a lot of money, and it also takes a lot of patience and community will to do that. And I think something like this really starts to get people wound up. I've been on committees before where we start going ahead, but when the price tag goes up, people get very, very anxious. Of course, $10 billion sounds like a huge amount of money, and it is. It's about the same amount that we took to build the Boston Big Dig project, so it's not a trifle. But these projects, even though they can amount to that level, can probably save themselves on one big storm like this.
Yeah, and we may have some saving in human lives, too. That's another big point. Could you tell us about surge protection devices installed in other parts of the world?
You know, when you travel through Europe, you know, you see these, well, the big project that most of us know about is in the Netherlands. I mean, there they've put polders or, you know, barriers against the sea up for miles. And then across the Scheldt River in the southwest of the Netherlands, they've got a series of barriers. Actually, there's quite a few of them. If you really want to go to study this thing, it requires kind of a massive undertaking because there's just so much going on in the Netherlands. But there's another big project in Italy. It's for Venice, and the Venice Lagoon, it actually has three major outlets to the sea, and they're really going to put basically barriers that come off of the bottom. In other words, they're hinged, and they pop up when you pump air into them. They just pop off the bottom, and they're built to withstand a pretty good surge there. Venice has had flooding for, well, a good 50 or 60 years that's been problematic. It's occurring because you have special winds that come down from the north and start to interact with the tidal dynamics to give you a surge in the upper Adriatic. The other places that the most famous probably is the Thames River downstream of London, and the Thames has been very operational for quite a few years now. And it basically stops the surges that come off the North Sea and would have really played havoc with London numerous times. Now, that project is an interesting one because it's a big one and it's important, but it was not designed very well for the latest sea level projections, say, to 2050. So they're going to have to probably replace that or amp it up. They can over-rotate. They have big rotating drums that come down and actually close off the sea. They're massive, about seven of them across the river. And they can over-rotate those to make them stand up a little bit higher. Again, that's another project that's, you know, rated in the billions of dollars. There's a smaller project that I've seen also in Belfast, in Northern Ireland. And that one is a smaller project, and it really is designed to basically do the same thing. There's North Sea surges that are a problem there, and it's closed off regularly. So these things are not unheard of. A lot of it, of course, now depends on this new thing that we've got, relatively new thing, is not only surges that occur on more regular frequencies, but these irregular hurricane kinds of problems, these cyclones. So we've got an array of projects around the developed world. Even the underdeveloped countries, though, would like to have more tidal protection, like Bangladesh. The Dutch have been trying to really work out a system for that low-lying country. And it's about the size of Wisconsin, but it's about half of it is just about at sea level, and you can easily get a 17 or 18-foot surge in there. Sometimes it goes to 22 feet. So there's a huge undertaking there, too. So it's not only confined to the developed countries, it's also the underdeveloped countries, especially the ones that are close to the sea.
Right. And the Bangladeshis, you said, built some storm survival structures that could be of interest.
Yeah, I think the Western world just hasn't been attuned to this. I went through it's a huge delta. It's the Ganges River combined with the Brahmaputra, and it's a fascinating place. They have a national park there with the Bengal tigers in it, so it's a very unique place to visit. It's wonderful. But on the periphery of the park, there are numerous towns and villages, and they get flooded not every year, but every 3 or 4, maybe 5 years sometimes. So they've turned to outside help to actually construct what they call cyclone shelters. So when they get a surge up the Bay of Bengal, they can go up into these structures. And at least during, you know, a week or so when the water is really high, they can find temporary shelter. And then when the water goes down, they can try to resume their lives. So it's one of those things that it's a quick stopgap. It doesn't really help you preserve things the way you might want, but at least it helps the population get through during the worst times.
And, of course, many of those people are already used to living without electricity, so it's a little bit more of a low-tech situation than we had in places like New York and New Jersey. Now, in your press conference briefing with Mike Tidwell of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, you and oceanographer William Boycourt warned about what might happen or what could have happened to Maryland and Virginia and the nation's capital if Hurricane Sandy had turned inland further south. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, we were worried at first that this thing might turn earlier to the west, and it was riding up on the Gulf Stream, and that's probably one of the reasons why it stayed as strong as it did. The Gulf Stream has warmer water, so you still have a lot of the cyclone being regenerated. Cooler water, the cyclones or hurricanes, as you can use those interchangeably, tend to dissipate. So this thing rode the Gulf Stream up, and if it would have gotten off the Gulf Stream a little earlier, turned west because of the front that was coming in, we might have had it in Chesapeake Bay. Now, it depends on where in Chesapeake Bay it actually enters, but if the tide surge on the strong side of the hurricane, which is usually you think about it as your northwest quadrant. Actually, if that wave enters the bay and propagates up the bay, you have a special situation in Chesapeake Bay where it's like a funnel, and the tidal energy that goes in through the capes gets amplified sometimes as you get towards the top of the bay, mostly due to what we call the resonance time of the estuary. And to make a long story short, you can really get, you know, a doubling of the wave as it comes up to Washington and Baltimore, which is where our population centers are.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor J. Court Stevenson. We're talking about what major cities could do to protect themselves from storm surges and rising seas in an era of climate change. Well, Professor Stevenson, let's look at Washington, D.C. If a big storm surge, say the 14-foot monster that hit Manhattan, if that came to Washington, D.C., what would happen there?
Well, you know, a lot of Washington is built on pretty high ground, but unfortunately for the national monuments on the Mall, most of those are pretty low-lying. It doesn't appear to be the case until you really look at some of the topography of the area. And when you really look at it pretty carefully, and FEMA has done this, and they're kind of aware that this is a potential issue, but we've actually projected one of the earlier storms, which is called Hurricane Isabel, happened in 2003, and Isabel came up and amplified the tide and had almost a worst-case track. If you really would have amped up Isabel's track with a little bit higher, it came in as a pretty low-level storm when it finally was at the bay. But if you amp that up, you get about 15 feet of surge in the Potomac right outside of Washington. So 15 feet means my favorite place to be in Washington, among the most favorite, is the National Archives. And you'd just about be at the basement of the National Archives, which actually kind of is frightening to me because a lot of our treasures are really there. But it actually could flood pretty wide area around the Mall. And, you know, I think that's a concern for a lot of people. The first reaction that I heard was that when FEMA wanted to reclassify the area, when they realized what kind of possibilities there were, and a lot of the people didn't want to be reclassified because these businesses would have had to pay more insurance. So they really sort of stymied the first attempt on that. I don't know how that is right now, but I know that there were thoughts about how to try to protect the Mall better, and I'd really like to see more action on that kind of a plan.
Could Washington and Baltimore be protected from a big storm surge?
Well, that's the question, and I think theoretically, yes, but again, it's just how much do you want to pay for what kind of a structure, and we really haven't studied the details of any of this, so it's really hard to say exactly, you know, what kind of construction we need and what kind of sediments we've got to really anchor big, you know, heavy equipment into, but, you know, based on some of the other areas of the world, it's definitely feasible. It's just a matter of where to put it and how that might affect the ecology of the area, which, you know, you really, the Potomac is really important in terms of its aquatic ecosystem, so you don't want to really do anything there that would ruin the estuary. So there's a lot of environmental as well as just engineering considerations.
And what about coastal residents outside these big cities?
Well, you know, I live in a county that's it's called Talbot County. It's pretty high. By that, I mean my house is 10 feet above mean sea level. But we have a county that's south of us. About a third of it is probably less than 5 feet. And that area, actually, 1933, largely flooded in a hurricane. Didn't have a name because we didn't name hurricanes previous to World War II. But the 33 hurricane came in and wiped out a lot of farmers' fields for a while because it brings salt up from the ocean, and that salt really prevents you to crop the land for quite a while. So the farmers were really pretty much, you know, out of business for a while. So that's the historical information we have on that. And unfortunately, you know, they've gone ahead and a lot of those farm fields are now in houses. Now, it's not dense housing, but it is really floodable areas, and it is vulnerable. And since it is a big part of the county, I think a number of us are worried about what to do. One of the things that you could do is try to find the high spot. There is a high ridge area that it's almost runs in a parallel line that you probably could protect. But below that, you'd probably have to just talk about managed retreat, which just means you'd probably try to buy out or encourage people to leave that area that on a permanent basis, but they might have summer homes there or something like that if they were elevated. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about in Chesapeake Bay. Now, nobody really wants to do that because the American spirit is basically pretty independent and nobody likes to be told what to do where. So, you know, we've had a lot of pushback on that.
You know, I'm wondering, is surge hardening anything more than a stopgap measure? I mean, top climate scientists like Dr. James Hansen of NASA say if we don't reduce greenhouse gases very quickly and soon, the normal sea level could rise up to 3 feet or a meter by 2100. And that's like a permanent high tide even before you have these big storms. I'm almost picturing we may have to pull back from some of these cities and a lot of the current coastal line. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm totally in agreement with Jim Hansen's warnings, and I think if you're really worried about your grandchildren and 2100 and beyond, I think we've really got to come up with a better plan. If we planned it, if we continue to really use the carbon reserves and coal and oil and the gas that we've got, if the world really goes to that extreme where we decide to pump it all out and use it in the next 100 or 200 years, 300 years, yeah, we definitely have to relocate cities. There's no question in my mind that that would be stopgap. Now, my idea basically is that, you know, as we progress, you know, economists will basically start to just figure out how much global warming will cost in terms of dislocations and adaptation. And my feeling is that you start to really understand the balance of what we're doing in terms of costs and benefits. And at that point, I think people would have to start to reassess their energy utilization, you know, not only in terms of quantity, but where it's coming from. So I think we all probably should worry about how much oil we're really using and what our footprint is. So I would totally agree with Dr. Hansen's assessment that this is kind of a stopgap measure, but I hope that it's sort of like, unlike the rest of the world, Americans seem to be really with their head in the sand on this in terms of what we should be doing to really make these places survivable that are along the coast.
Yeah, I read that the state of Virginia passed a law expressly forbidding accounting for rising seas in planning documents. Is that true?
Well, I think you're probably more thinking about North Carolina, where the state legislature actually, on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which is a very narrow band of sand that goes on the outer coast. It's a beautiful place, but it is very precarious in terms of sea level rise and surge. The communities there were actively worried about sea level, and a number of interests and trenchants got a law passed from the state legislatures, which said initially that they were going to have to reassess their assessments with the view that they were no longer to use future projections, but only past evidence of sea level rise to really decide where to put structures like condominiums and whatnot. That's been withdrawn. I think it was passed by one house, but not the other. And now there's a committee that's looking into the whole thing. But what's interesting, the scientists have a few seats on the committee, but there's also a huge interest among the developers and real estate people that tend to feel that we don't need to put any brakes on development anywhere along the bank. So I think it's one of those tragedies that has emerged along the East Coast. It's most of the states are probably trying to do something. I know Florida is, and I know Maryland has really been on the forefront, but Virginia has been a little behind, but they have a big naval base down at Norfolk, and I know that talking to the Department of Defense people that they are very anxious about sea level rise, and they've started to formulate plans on at least some dikes, polders kind of around the periphery of some of their most vulnerable areas already. So I think actually Virginia is slowly coming around to the idea, I think, that, you know, they're going to have to do more on that.
Well, I'm sorry to say we've run out of time. Our guest has been Professor J. Cort Stevenson from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science in Cambridge, Maryland. Maybe we can talk again. I think there's a lot more here. Thank you so much for helping us out.
Well, you're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
On the other side of the Atlantic, it seems like a different planet. Politicians, the media, and the broad public long ago accepted the science of climate change. Under the stress of depending on imported energy, Germany and Denmark decided to make the switch to renewables. In Germany, progressive parties like the Greens were elected. They didn't want to rely on big corporate power either. So Germany set a severe target to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to just 40% of their 1990 levels by 2020, and they want to do it with distributed energy sources. Germany is ahead of that schedule. In a period during the summer of 2012, they were able to power their entire electrical needs from renewables alone in the most highly industrialized nation in Europe. Daphne Weisham, longtime host of Earthbeat Radio, is now with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She traveled to Germany and Denmark last summer to discover how this renewable energy renaissance happened. Here Daphne speaks with Herman Ott. He's a lawyer with the Wuppertal Institute for Climate, Environment, and Energy, but he's on leave while he sits as a member of the German Federal Parliament for the Green Party.
What is the strategy for the Green Party, first of all, in terms of advancing the energy revolution? Is there a focus on decentralized renewables versus sort of large-scale centralized approach of maybe more offshore wind? And how do you see that playing out in the coming years?
Actually, if you look at it, even our wind power, 70% of that is in the hands of private individuals. And solar, of course, most of it. And that's based on it's basically like the internet. I mean, the internet, the function was to be indestructible, to guard against nuclear strikes. So it was kind of set up not as a hierarchical kind of network, but interconnected. And in our opinion, and that's also part of the green philosophy, first of all, it should be in the hands of the people. They should profit from it. And second, it's much more safe than if you've got large companies doing it. And, of course, there's also kind of a slight anti-kind of business route in there. So empower the people and not more profit to the companies. The result is, for example, the renewable energy law, which put that into concrete legal form, and which has led to a revolution. I mean, if you look at the landscape in Germany, many parts, you see windmills everywhere. And solar is just coming the same way. Nobody expected it that fast, actually. Especially regarding wind power, it had also led to the fact that people have less resistance. I mean, if you're part of it, if you profit mm-hmm. from it, well, it may be a nuisance, but at least I'm winning. And so that's a side effect, which was not intended, but it's, of course, also very valuable. And we conceive for the future a mix. I mean, there will be some large hydro, large offshore, probably large solar, concentrated solar power in southern Europe or northern Africa. But as we perceive it, this will not be the backbone. It will be the backbone will be the decentralized. But as you know very well, I mean, sometimes plans do not develop the way it was set out before. So we don't know, really. But that's our idea. We doubt that the large concentrated solar power stations actually bring the results that they expected. We doubt that biomass can be used in the quantity that some studies presuppose.
In terms of the concentrated solar, and right. I've heard about some of these plans in the north of Africa that suggest that one power plant in Morocco could provide all of its energy needs or something along those lines.
Well, not all, but 15%, yeah.
Do you doubt that that's possible, or you just feel that that's not the desirable approach to take?
It depends. The devil is in the detail. And on the one hand, it can be made into a tool that fosters cooperation between Europe and Africa, where local people profit from it, and where actually in terms of jobs, but also in terms of energy. But it could also easily be turned into a colonialist kind of tool to exploit our poor people in Africa. That is the other side of the coin, and the devil lies in the details here. We would, of course, like it to be an instrument for cooperation and benefit of the people in Africa, but it can easily turn into the country. But in general, our line is that we are not opposing it, but we are not actively fostering it, supporting it. Our main idea for future energy or electricity production, for that matter, is decentralized power from wind, solar, some biomass, not too much actually, because there's a competition with food. But what's the main challenge at the moment is, of course, to get the grid fit for this kind of electricity production and to provide the storage. It's going very fast. Well, if I'm allowed this party politics remark, this government is not doing enough to increase the ability of the grid to cope with 25% renewables, and on storage is not doing anything.
If they were to do more, would it be in the form of, say, a smart grid, or what are you proposing that they do in terms of the grid?
Well, that's certainly part of it, but we don't only need smart grids. We need some kind of extension, not as much as industry normally purports. And there's a study that claims that we need 3,500 kilometers new high-voltage lines. But that supposes, of course, that all the renewable energies produced in the north, wind power, offshore and onshore, and it's consumed in the south. So you need lots of new lines. But the new green-red government in Baden-Württemberg has made it clear that they are now heading towards a sizable amount of renewables themselves. And Bavaria is following, which is governed by a conservative government. So there will be extensive renewables also, electricity production in the south of Germany.
Does the Green Party play a pivotal role in all of this, or is it really just something that has become so accepted by the general population, that the notion that we need to advance renewable energy within Germany? Is it being pushed actively by the Greens, or is it been taken up by all?
Well, we are mainly connected with the success of renewables. That has historical reasons, especially the renewable energy law from 1998-99 under a red-green coalition that led to the boost in renewables that we have now. And we are also the political force that actively fights against cutting back the regulations that favor renewable energy. But it's also part of the wider society, of course. And sometimes I think that's exactly the reason why it will succeed, because people don't want nuclear. I mean, after Fukushima, 80% of the Germans were against. Before it was 60. Now it would probably be back to 65 or something. But there's a deep-rooted conviction that nuclear energy is bad, really bad. And for alternatives, you can't turn to fossils because they foster climate change. So there's only one solution, and that is renewables. And sometimes I think it is a small part of the population that is actually needed only to determine the atmosphere within a society. Mm-hmm. You have a bad example now in the US with the Tea Party, which is a relatively small faction of the Republican Party, but is dominating discussions. So, I mean, it has got hegemony in a way, so that everybody has to relate to it. And a positive example is actually the relatively small part of the population that in the 70s started doubting nuclear energy, fighting against it, developing alternatives. And there was real freaks that went out into the countryside and live on their own electricity. They wanted to be autonomous. And this made it possible to have a climate atmosphere now in our society which is very, very pro-renewables. And that's why I think we will succeed.
So in terms of the feed-in tariff, do you feel that that was pivotal in the success of getting renewables to take off in Germany?
Absolutely. One of the most genius creations in legal history that I know, because it doesn't take state subsidies. I mean, it's the consumers in the end paying themselves. It provides prime access to the grid. The grid owner is required to allow renewable energy. And it provides for a long-term perspective investment security, because you know that for the next 20 years you get that return on your investment. And that was it in the end.
And it seems that quite a few countries are following your lead. It looks like Japan might be considering a feed-in for renewables, and India's.
There's almost 50 countries, but most of them actually have a softer model, which has got a cap on the amount of money that is actually in Spain. I think it was 1 billion. In China, I know a guy who was in China, and he said, our renewable energy law made it up to the top in the Politburo, but then was stopped there because they were afraid they would get out of hand. Mm. They wanted to have it under their control. So they have got a softer version. But all in all, it's, I think, 50 countries now that have followed it, because it actually empowers the people, and it unleashes an investment. I mean, if you look at the growth rates in terms of gigawatt hours, you couldn't actually build that in conventional power. I mean, you can do it in China because they don't have any the environmental protection or the procedural rules that you have to follow. But you couldn't do it in one of our countries. So it's actually also a very, very active tool for increasing electricity production. It's absolutely clear that our present and our predicted energy supply cannot come from renewables, and it should not come from renewables.
Cannot come from renewables?
No, and it should not, because we kind of use any inch of the Earth's surface to produce some kind of energy, if you look at the projections. And one of the results of our working group in the Parliamentary Commission is that the rebound effect is extremely strong.
Explain what you mean by that.
Rebound is the phenomenon that if you have an increase in efficiency, cars, in lamps or whatever, much of the increase is eaten up again by the changed behavior of the people. So you let the light burn longer, or you drive more kilometers, or you save money by isolating your home and spend it on a tour into China, or to Europe, for that matter. And actually, there's a phenomenon called backfire, where the emissions after the efficiency increases are higher than before. And that's why saving energy and using energy more efficiently is prime. So we have to look at those together. I mean, one is renewable energy. We need that. And it won't be too long that all the energy will be supplied by renewables, we're sure. But we also need to make sure that we decrease the amount of energy that we use. In the Wuppertal Institute, where I used to work, we had this rule of thumb down to one-third. So if we go down to one-third of the present energy consumption and produce that with renewable energy, then it will be fine, and there will be no competition between electricity production and food production, for example, which could actually turn into a major problem in the future. So renewables is great, but at the same time, we need to reduce our consumption of energy.
That was Hermann Ott, a member of the German Federal Parliament for the Green Party. He was interviewed in Berlin during the summer of 2012 by Daphne Weisham from the Institute of Policy Studies. My thanks to Daphne for sharing this valuable insight with Radio Ecoshock listeners into the way it could be, even in North America. Find links to follow up on all our guests and topics in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. By the way, downloads of our programs doubled in October, going over 50,000 shows downloaded in just 1 month. My thanks to everyone who listened and shared our programs. The costs for bandwidth are going up. If you can help keep this ball rolling, getting some sanity out there, please hit the new donate button on our blog or at the website www.ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. We'll go out as we came in with more from Billy Joel at the Hurricane Sandy Benefit Concert in New York, live November 2nd, hosted by NBC. The song is Miami 2017, and I found it on YouTube.
Ago,
before we all move down to Florida, before the mafia took over Mexico.